Welcome to another episode of Crown and Crozier, the podcast on church, state, and faithful citizenship. I'm your host, Patrick Brown. Anticipation has been building in the lead up to the visit of a delegation of Indigenous elders, youth, and residential school survivors to the Vatican. This visit, which will include a series of private audiences with the Holy Father, comes on the heels of heightened debate and dialogue in Canada around the legacy of the residential school system. The profile of this issue was elevated following the announcement in May 2021 that the remains of 215 children in unmarked graves had been discovered on the site of a former residential school near Kamloops, British Columbia. With all the attention on this meeting at the Vatican and the larger issue of residential schools, we thought we'd do something a bit different for this episode. For this conversation, we're focusing on the personal story of Father Cristino Bouvet, an Indigenous priest in the Diocese of Calgary, whose Cree grandmother was forced to attend a residential school in Alberta. Our dialogue with Father Bouvet touches on the enduring faith of his grandmother, or Kokum, the blend of Christian identity and Indigenous heritage in his family, as well as what authentic reconciliation means and demands from all of us. Father Bouvet serves as the Vicar of Vocations and Young Adults in the Diocese of Calgary, as well as the chaplain for the diocese's youth ministry, the St. Francis Xavier Council. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast, like us on Twitter or on Facebook, or refer us to a friend. Thanks for tuning in and enjoy the show.
There are two swords, and the question is, which sword is superior, the spiritual sword or the temporal sword?
And without God, democracy will not and cannot long endure.
I die His Majesty's good servant, at God's first.
Delighted to welcome our guest, Father Cristino Bouvet. Father Cristino, thanks so much for joining Crown and Crozier.
Thank you for having me on.
Given all the attention on the Indigenous delegation visit to the Vatican in late March, here at Crown and Crozier, we also wanted to turn our focus to the event and to the issue of residential schools in a way that would help both bring light and would also be faithful to our mission to help bring souls to Christ. So ultimately, we thought there was no better way to achieve these goals than to provide a platform for telling one of the many, many beautiful stories of the membership of Indigenous brothers and sisters in the mystical body of Christ, our church, and the passing down of the Christian faith across the generations among our Indigenous brethren. So Father Cristino, we're truly blessed to have you as our guest and as our storyteller today. And to start us off, perhaps you can just give us an introduction of yourself and tell us more about your family's Indigenous ancestry.
Great. Well, thank you very much. And it's an honor to be on your podcast with you. I enjoy listening to it. One of the things that I usually say when I first begin introducing myself, especially in light of the greater exposure I'm getting in this context, is that I always have considered myself a funny combination, if you will. My mother is the daughter of Italian immigrants who came to Canada in the late 1950s, and she was raised in a small southeastern Albertan town called Medicine Hat. And my father is of Indigenous heritage. His mother is predominantly Cree, and his father was Métis. And so for your listeners who may not be familiar, those who are Métis are a distinct group that we recognize among or under the larger umbrella in Canada of Indigenous peoples who are themselves a combination of some European ancestry as well as First Nations ancestry. And a distinct culture and way of life really grew up from among them. And so in my own blood, then, I have this on my father's side, the Cree and Métis ancestry, and on my mother's side, the Italian. And so for me personally, growing up, it didn't seem like there was anything awkward or weird about that. I was that kid who brought a loaf of bannock and a bowl of homemade pasta to the cultural luncheon that we would have in school from time to time. And those just seemed like complimentary things to me. It wasn't until quite a bit later, in my late teens, that I became even more aware of the legacy of residential schools in our country, of which I had only ever really been aware that my grandmother, who I called Kokum, my Cree grandmother, was a student there for her entire education. in one of those schools. And so as my own awareness grew about both the legacy as well as the long-lasting impacts it seemed to have on so many people, I only then began to ask the questions as to what happened to her specifically and how did she handle that experience. And then in the seminary, it sort of came full circle. I realized the great intersection that there was between the history of the Catholic Church's contribution towards the residential school system, how many of them were staffed by priests and religious brothers and sisters. And now my grandmother, who herself wasn't a Catholic, but was always a very devout Christian woman, now had a grandson who could become a Catholic priest. And so it did begin to cause me some anxiety as to wondering, how did she feel about that? She was very supportive when I went to the seminary, but did that indicate that she just wanted to be supportive of her grandson, but maybe inside she was wrestling with some mixed feelings towards that. And I was very blessed to discover that there were no mixed feelings at all. She was unequivocally supportive of my vocation. And after I was ordained, already then began to say that she thought that I may have a unique role to play in the future of reconciliation between Indigenous Canadians and our church.
So may I ask, and certainly to the extent you're willing and comfortable, what were the types of stories that were passed down to you when you were a teenager around your grandmother's experience? And what do you remember in terms of that window of time in your youth where these things began to make their way to your attention?
That first came to me through my father, of course, the son of my grandmother, and one of his sisters to whom we were especially close. My father was the youngest of 14 children.
Oh, wow.
And so he had an older sister who also had moved to Medicine Hat. And so our two families were very close. And that aunt of mine is actually a great leader among the Indigenous people in Alberta. She's an educator, and she worked for many years in First Nations, Métis, and Inuit relations in the province of Alberta through the school system. And so between the two of them, I started to catch glimpses of the fact that Kokum's upbringing and schooling was in one way traumatic, but that there was a further tragedy, which was the overall loss of access to her culture and her language. This is something that I've reflected on increasingly now, but as I mentioned, I have Italian grandparents, and I happen to have inherited the gift of understanding and being able to make myself understood in the Italian language, despite being two generations removed from their homeland. And yet my grandmother, whose ancestry is this homeland, was not able to pass on her language to me. She herself became more proficient over the course of her life, but certainly wasn't something spoken in her home, her Cree language. And so just becoming aware of that prompted more and more questions. And then I began to see that no one was very comfortable talking about it in too great of detail. So it wasn't until after I was a priest that I think my grandmother began to open up to me in a way that maybe she hadn't. Well, she certainly had never opened up to me. I don't know how much she had opened up to others in our family, but she started sharing with me more about some of the particular details of what she found most troubling and burdensome about what she remembered. And one of the things that struck me was she lived to be 99 years and 11 months old. She died 1 month shy of her 100th birthday in 2019. And sometimes the conversation came up in her 90s, if maybe she should go to a home. Would she be cared for better? Would she feel safer? Would the rest of us feel safer if she was living there? And she used to say, I grew up in an institution and I'm not going to die in an institution. And so that tells you something about just her general reaction to that thought. 70, 80 years later brought her back to that institutionalized experience of her education.
So may I ask, how did your grandmother come to the faith? Did she grow up in a Christian household? And what was the history or the dynamic there?
That is perhaps the most beautiful part of the story. She was a devout Christian woman, irrespective of the education she received in the residential school, because she is of a generation, three generations of Christian tradition. Her great-grandfather is a fairly well-known, at least in Western Canada, Methodist minister, a man by the name of Reverend Henry Bird, and he later took another last name in honor of a benefactor who sponsored his seminary training, a German physician, and his last name was Steinhauer. And so the Reverend Henry Bird Steinhauer, we tend to just pronounce it now as Steiner, came out west and was one of the very first Indigenous men in Canada, even before Confederation. He was ordained in the Methodist Church in 1855 and came to Alberta, where he began to establish settlements in places where there were already pre-existing communities, mostly of Cree Native people, and preach the gospel to them. And in addition to preaching the gospel, he actually worked to translate the New Testament into Cree in a written language, and their hymns, their liturgical services. And so that was a deeply ingrained part of my Kokum's family, well before there was even a residential school system. And so Christianity was not something imposed upon her or something that she happened to even willingly accept in her schooling. It was something that she was born into and never strayed from.
May I ask, did she ever talk about how she ended up in the school system? Some children were forcibly removed from their homes. My understanding is some students were enrolled voluntarily by their parents. I mean, did she ever talk about how she ended up in the school to begin with?
Yeah, she was taken from her family. She never described it to me. She never described it in a way that it was akin to something like a kidnapping. What my understanding was that this wasn't really something that you were given much of a choice about. So I don't think the Mounties came and rounded up a bunch of kids and threw them in the back of a train car and took them away. But it wasn't as though you had the option to opt in or out of going to the residential school. When you became educational age, when she was 6 years old, she was just brought by train to the Edmonton Indian Residential School for Girls, as it was called. And that was now by car, around an hour and a bit away from Edmonton. And so it was quite the journey, you can imagine. That was in 1926 that she was taken. And so it was certainly a difficult experience for her to have had to have gone in that way.
After she attended the school, what was the rest of her life and her life journey like? And did she still hold and profess the faith at the end of her life?
Oh, she grew stronger by the day. In fact, I would say that she eventually began to migrate more towards an even more mainstream, traditional, liturgical expression of Christianity. I think there were a number of fallings out in the 60s and 70s with her and the United Church of Canada. The Methodist Church that she was first baptized into has what became the United Church of Canada. By the time of her death, she was attending what you might call a pretty traditional Lutheran congregation, but was also very open to the Catholic tradition that my father came into before marrying my mother and really adopted truly as something of his own. And so she was also very open to that. Whenever she'd visit us in Medicine Hat, she'd come to Mass with us. She marked the celebration of all of our sacraments. She thought that those were all very important. And even though it wasn't something she shared in, she valued it. And so she really did begin to move more, I would say, in that direction. But not a day went by that she did not begin her morning with meditation and intercessory prayer. And every night she would read from a devotional magazine published by some branch of a Lutheran synod called The Upper Room. And she would have that as a method of praying with scripture as well as meditating upon a particular theme in that passage. And that was something she did very faithfully that I did countless times with her also in my life and treasure those memories.
May I ask, did she have a career in life or was she focused on family? And, you know, how large a family did your father grow up in? And was it the intent of your Kokum to pass down the faith to her children?
Yes, it certainly was. She had a life marked by continuous suffering. I've often said that residential school was only the first glimpse of what would be a lifelong suffering. To have been born in 1919 and on just the tail end of the Great War, she, along with everyone else, was on near starvation throughout most of the Great Depression. and in the residential school during that time. She married in 1939, the man to whom she would remain married and for the rest of his life. He died many years before her. But they had one child soon after marriage. And while she had not yet, I believe, had not yet discovered she was expecting their second child, he was deployed overseas in the Canadian Armed Forces to fight in the Second World War. And he was apart from them for 3.5 years, during which most of the time she didn't know whether he was alive or dead, and gave birth to their second child without him for that whole time. And I guess you could say they made up for lost time because he came home, thankfully, alive from the war, but they had 12 more children. And my grandmother tragically buried her fourth child, I believe, and he died when he was 18 months old. And so that was, of course, another unspeakable burden in her life. And then many more children after that. So she, my little sister asked her one time, "Kokum, what did you do?" She said, "Well, I was a mummy." And she said, "No, I mean, what was your real job?" And she said, "I just had babies for 21 years, practically." And so that was really what she did with her life. She ran that home. There's a beautiful story that I have reflected on a lot. It was one of the last conversations I probably had with her. But I asked, when she was trying to manage a household of that size, did she have any routines or rhythms that she needed to put in place? And she said, "Well, of course, everything went around baking bread. I scheduled everything around when I would bake bread." And I asked her, "What was a typical batch of bread that she would make?" She said, "Well, I would make 22 loaves on a Wednesday and another 22 loaves on a Saturday. And if I didn't have enough on Sunday night, I'd make buns for dinner." And it just boggled my mind to imagine that her life somehow, there's something even, I guess you could say, mysterious, spiritually mysterious around that idea that their family life hinged around the baking of bread.
The multiplication of the loaves.
And the multiplication of the loaves, because she never knew how many mouths there was going to be to feed there. My grandfather operated a sawmill, portable sawmill, and he moved it all over the place. And he had his sons-in-law, his neighbors, whoever was a free hand, they were working on the sawmill. And so she never knew who was showing up to sit around that table at dinner time. So she just, that was her true passion, was caring for her family. But later in life, after all of her children were raised, she was a key mover in the establishment and operation of something called the Friendship Center. There are friendship centers, at least I'm aware of them across Western Canada, that tend to be places of community interaction between Indigenous people and the wider community. There's a variety of programs and services that are offered from out of them. And so she operated the one in near to where their farm was, in a little place called Rocky Mountain House in central Alberta. So she was the executive director of that Friendship Center for a number of years, around the same time that my grandfather took on a leadership role in the Métis Association of Alberta. She was a very accomplished woman. There was nothing she could not do. And despite that, her primary focus was always on her family.
I'm getting the sense, I certainly don't mean to put words in your mouth, but I don't get the sense, based on everything that you've just described in terms of the family culture, I don't get the sense that they saw any type of contradiction in being simultaneously Indigenous and Christian. It's not like they would have said, "I'm a Christian despite being Indigenous." Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely. She would have said that in the origins of Christianity being observed in their family, it was her great-grandfather, as I mentioned earlier, the Reverend Henry Bird Steiner, who taught the family that these things were not incompatible with each other. Now, I have understood later in his life, through some of my own research that I've done, that he did begin to call into question the integrity of the missionary impulse of the Methodist Church. I think he did begin to detect the early stages of what now we would call colonization and the possibility that Indigenous way of life and culture was just going to seek to be stamped out. And then he did begin to resist that tendency. And so I think even in his own life before his death, he began to see the need to try and hone that in a little bit and maintain the harmony that he believed could exist between those things. And so I believe that there must have been periods of tension, a bit of a pendulum maybe, back and forth between those two poles in the respective generations, including even up to Mike Holcomb's generation. But I would then say that now in my generation, anyone who is struggling with what they would consider to be irreconcilable in the name of colonization is ironically, I believe, something much more an imposition upon people of my age and generation by the predominant culture than actually rooted in a history or lived history of the people who preceded us, because it wasn't always such a divisive point of contention, as it were, between an indigenous heritage and the Christian confession.
Reflecting on all of this and listening to all this, I'm reminded of that line from St. Paul's letter to the Corinthians, where he talks about Christ crucified being a stumbling block to the Jews and the Gentiles. And I can't help but think that we seem to have reached a place, at least in Canadian culture and society, where just the notion or the prospect of being indigenous and Christian it's a stumbling block. To people on the outside, it seems like there's this sense of just not being able to grasp that as a viable prospect based on how the legacy of residential schools and other indigenous issues is interpreted. But let's perhaps talk a little bit more about your spiritual journey. And in particular, I'm curious to know when you started to discern the priesthood and whether your process of discerning the priesthood, did it start before this awareness of your family's history and heritage?
Well, it certainly began to take root before I was aware of that, because even from a young age, 5 or 6 years old, I would say that I wanted to become a priest, but I just didn't understand what that meant, and certainly not the full implications of what a life as a priest would entail. In my hometown of Medicine Hat, it was with my Italian grandparents that I spent the most amount of time. My father's mother, Mike Holcomb, lived 5.5 hours away from us on the farm. And so I'd see her a couple of times a year. She'd come down maybe once or twice a year too. So, you know, 4 or 6 times a year, we'd have a visit, but I couldn't say I was immersed in a culture or an upbringing with her, but I was with my nonna and nonno, because they lived around the corner from us. And so they impressed upon me a deep love for our Catholic faith. And it was my nonno, actually, when I was 9 years old, who said, you know, I think what you make a nicer priest. You should be a nicer priest. And it inspired me because I really looked up to him. He was sort of my mentor as a young boy. And that he thought I should be a priest gave me the courage to actually be more resolved about that, even to the point of being mercilessly teased in my Catholic elementary school, ironically, that I even admitted I wanted to be a priest. And that would go back and forth throughout my adolescence. But when I finally made the decision, I was very influenced by the visit of Pope John Paul II to Canada in 2002 for World Youth Day. And I decided that I needed to just go to the seminary right after high school. I was still finishing high school in the early 2000s. And I decided that I could get it out of my system that way. It still by then had never occurred to me that one day I might consider myself, or the world might consider me, an enigma, being a person of indigenous heritage and choosing freely and happily to be a Catholic priest. Because, as I said, at the time, I only really understood that Mike Holcomb had gone to these schools that were being talked about in an increasingly hostile manner. Even she herself just sort of talked about it by saying, I don't like talking about it. And so it wasn't a predominant part of my interactions with her. In the seminary was only when I began to realize what the depths of that intersection actually implied, and that this was potentially going to be something that I would have to resolve or wrestle with interiorly, because I started to hear the rhetoric really ramping up. But then it wasn't until after I was ordained, and in light of the very well-publicized work of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, that I saw, okay, this is going to be, there is no escaping this dynamic in my life. And so I need to find a way to address it pastorally, but also authentically and with integrity.
What were some of the steps that you did to position and prepare yourself in that regard?
Well, it began when I was informed by Bishop Henry, who was my ordaining bishop in 2012, that my first assignment was going to be in a parish in southwest Calgary that was adjacent to a reserve just outside of the city limits, which meant that part of my pastoral work would be to go and serve the parish at the Tsuut'ina Nation. And that excited me. I thought, oh, perfect. I'll have a shoe in. I'll have a natural connection there with the people, which I did, and which became the beginning of a truly beautiful first pastoral encounter as a priest. In that neighborhood where that parish was, there was a fairly strong presence of old Italian people. And then on the other side of the highway was this reserve. I just swung seamlessly back and forth between being out in someone's house on the reserve, starting whatever we thought we were going to start an hour and a half late, and just laughing about it and having moose meat stew and a slice of bannock, and then head back into town and sit and have coffee with an old Italian couple and speak Italian for an hour. To me, it was all just pastoral work that I happened to have the ability to swing in between. But when I realized that there was the need of a unique kind of pastoral care at Tsuut'ina, that's when I engaged my kokum for her direction and her wisdom very explicitly. And so I began making more regular visits on my day off because she was only an hour and a half away. I'd drive up to the farm and I'd spend a day with her. And we'd bake bread together or can vegetables or whatever we were doing. And I just listened to her. And she always had such wisdom for me. And her continuous refrain was that we had to move forward, that our future and our healing were contingent upon wanting freedom and seeking freedom. And that she wanted me to be part of that, to play a role in that. And so getting my feet wet in those first 2 years while I was assigned to serve at Tsuut'ina gave me the confidence that despite only being partially Indigenous, I could still be accepted and respected in that cultural setting, that I wasn't going to just be disregarded because I wasn't native enough, as it were, but that I had to bring an authentic witness to my Catholic faith, not water it down, not apologize for it, and to honor, particularly on that reserve, those elders who, despite all they had been through, have kept their Catholic faith. I owed it to them to give an authentic witness to that. And my kokum insisted that I was doing no one any favors by trying to be sort of soft on our Christianity or apologetic that we were Christians in the first place, in the interest of gaining credibility with the people that I was serving. And so that was when I really, I would say, I felt emboldened that these two could be together. And the most encouraging sign to me was when I moved to another parish, not that far away, but a decent number of kilometers, 10 or 15 kilometers east of where I had been, that the people still would come to visit occasionally to that parish. And they stayed in touch with me. I was invited back to concelebrate at a particular funeral. So I knew that I had made an impact that was accepted and had the capacity to be extended further into my priestly ministry.
That's a beautiful, profound revelation and insight to foster early on in your experience as a priest. I mean, in the subsequent years, how would you describe the manner in which you've grown or evolved that practice? And is what you're doing today, does it largely resemble that initial pastoral approach at that time that you just described? Or how has it matured? And what are you doing perhaps differently now, if anything? Or has that model simply proven its worth and you've carried it forward?
Well, certainly in the years 2015, 2016, when the Truth and Reconciliation Commission were doing their work in earnest, I was only a year removed from that experience of working at Sutina. And so when I started to hear the sorts of things that, as I said earlier, the rhetoric really ramping up, the very anti-Christian, anti-clerical rhetoric, I knew that that just simply did not represent the experience and opinions of all Indigenous people, and that it was unfair and unjustified to present it as though it were the predominant perspective. Even if numerically it could be calculated that a numerical majority of people of Indigenous heritage or those who had some contact with residential school system held some kind of anti-Christian, anti-Catholic, anti-clerical bias, that majority doesn't get to mute the experience of those for whom that was not the case, or for whom it would have been the case if they had not undertaken the work that they did personally to seek to pursue and achieve forgiveness and freedom and reconciliation. And so in my ministry, there was nothing specifically geared towards what I was doing at that time that lent itself towards taking a more public or vocal stance in response to what I was experiencing. But I just made sure to keep having conversations, individual conversations. And when I'd hear something in particular settings, I would not be afraid to give my perspective or to identify the fact that maybe what you're saying is true and would be the accurate depiction of some people, but to be mindful that it didn't represent everyone. And I think where things took a very significant turn for me personally would have been last year, when the purported location of those 215 graves at the school, former school site in Kamloops, really took the news by storm. My instinctive reaction was that I had to say something about this, that I could not just keep my head down and avoid what I knew inevitably could become conflict. And I asked my bishop to what extent he was comfortable allowing me to have a more prominent voice. And he's been very supportive in giving me an opportunity to give a testimony from my personal experience, but also my pastoral experience, as to how we already have been moving forward as a church in this, and how we must remain unequivocally committed to continuing on that path. And so that's where things have taken a real turn for me now, because this isn't even remotely part of my ministry per se, the assigned ministry of what I'm doing. I'm the vocation director of our diocese and I conduct young adult chaplaincy. But when I delivered a homily a few weeks after the news broke about the graves in Kamloops, addressing this dynamic, and I saw how it was received and circulated and people were asking me to comment further upon it, I realized that it was touching a chord that even if it wasn't seemingly part of my actively assigned ministry, it needed to become a part of my ministry because I had something unique to be able to contribute. And especially in the lives of my young adults and our students on campus, publicly identifying as a Catholic in the face of that was an insurmountable challenge for some of them, depending on the faculties in which they studied. And so feeling like they had the support of their chaplain, who is Indigenous, I realized was going to have to be an indispensable component of the way that I tried to help accompany them through the pain of this that we mourn together as a church.
I mean, what was the reaction like from your parishioners, whether Indigenous or non-Indigenous?
I think overwhelmingly grateful that something was being said. I think too often people expect the church to say nothing. And I know a great topic, or what maybe even the modus operandi of your podcast, is to specifically consider the relationship between the church and state, between public discourse and the public practice of our faith. And the reason that there is such a podcast is because we do it so poorly or so infrequently on a great many topics. So when people see that a person who is speaking with a public voice of even limited authority in the church is actually saying something, I think it brings them a sense of encouragement that we are not yet again just putting our heads down and hoping to let another tidal wave pass us by if we don't get swept away by it. That was the sense that I got from people, that they were grateful to hear that there was a voice that didn't feel the need to just keep my mouth shut and beat my breast and say, I'm sorry, but to offer a perspective that would likely not be represented otherwise.
And for your students, tell us more about how this issue in particular is a challenge for them in their lives on campus. For our Canadian listeners, it's generally well understood the magnitude and the gravity of this issue. This is a dominant issue in our discourse, in our society, in our culture. For listeners from other countries, part of the way I would explain it, the residential school legacy, I think it ranks up there with the Crusades, the Inquisition, the treatment of Galileo, religious wars in Europe, the sex abuse scandal, as chapters in the history of the church, which are wielded as cudgels by skeptics and adversaries of the church. I personally don't think it's exaggerating to rank residential schools in a Canadian context up there with those other things that I just mentioned. And I can't imagine what it's like for your students that you minister to carry that with them and to try to live out their faith in a university setting. I mean, can you speak to that a little bit more?
Well, I think the first way that I began to notice that they were suffering was being immediately identified as, if you publicly proclaim your Catholicity, then you must instantaneously sympathize with the church on the question of the residential schools. And if you sympathize with the church, then it's an automatically drawn conclusion that you are a racist, a colonizer, you name it, whatever are the corresponding accusations that can be drawn from out of that line of thinking. And so these are young people who are already willing to take a risk to go out on a limb by publicly identifying themselves as practicing Catholics, but now they do it at the risk of being publicly humiliated as sympathizing with something that they would say they don't even know that much about. And this is where I would always start with our students to say, you tell me what you know about the residential school system and the involvement of the church in it. And this is, again, in keeping with the conclusion of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's findings. They just didn't know. They knew that there was such a thing, but they really didn't understand why it was there. They didn't know how far-reaching it affected the lives of its students. And they were suspicious of the really vile things that they heard happened there, but also didn't know whether or not they could just dismiss them all right out of hand. Okay, fine. So if that's what you're admitting, that you don't really know, well, I then would say, don't be afraid to ask your interlocutors or your accusers, well, what do you know? And that you heard someone give a testimony somewhere that said, nuns took children out of their beds at night and shot them or something like that. And these are the kinds of things that we hear reported about. I think it's fair for them to say, how do you know that? How have you obtained that information? We need to learn to first differentiate between what is part of the hyped up presentation of this historical saga, this tragedy, from what actually occurred. And secondly, we have to guard ourselves against supposing that we can impute motives to perpetrators of historical action when we are removed from the historical context. And what I'm finding is that there's just a lack of rationality behind the discourse, if we can even call it discourse. I don't think that it even constitutes discourse so often. And so the way that I tried to encourage our students was to say, do not defend the church. Do not say, yeah, but I know a really good priest and he's indigenous. So those are not contributing to discourse either. But identify what is missing. Identify where you see a problem, where you see a hole in whatever semblance of an argument is being presented, so that we don't stray too far away. We cannot let people make the argument for us that we have to defend ourselves against. We need to make sure that we are setting the appropriate terms in the first place. It's often been noted that the first act of the intellect is the definition of terms. Well, you just used a lot of words in all of this, whatever you want to call it, that you've hurled against me. Let's start defining, what do you mean by each of those words? Because until I know what you're talking about and the way you're employing that language, I can't even respond to it. And when we take it and put it into the context of rational discourse, if the person isn't prepared to have it, then they'll just walk away from it. And now your accuser has walked away from you. Okay, that's unfortunate, because there is no good to be had from not having rational discourse. But we should be prepared to insist that that's what happens and not submit ourselves to the cudgel, as you put it, of just being beaten over the head with an accusation that we can't actually defend ourselves against in the first place.
A lot of this dovetails really nicely with one of the themes I want to make sure we give ample time to, the theme of reconciliation. And to your point around defining the terms, the word reconciliation arguably dominates a lot of the public discourse on this topic. Based on your experience, based on your involvement in this issue, what is true authentic reconciliation, and how do you think we get there?
That again comes to the question of defining our terms. And when I believe someone is open to this rational discourse I keep referring to, I tend to ask them, are they prepared to differentiate between reconciliation and retribution? If this was called the Truth and Retribution Commission, I think people would have understood what it was about. And I don't think there would have been very many people opposed to it going after those ends, digging up and manifesting the truth and then demanding retribution. I don't think anyone would have been opposed to such an operation. But if that is what some want to see happen, but everyone is having applied to it the word reconciliation, well, now we're going to run into a problem. Because there will be those who do want reconciliation who will say, I'm not into all of this other stuff about name-calling and further accusations and the demanding of all sorts of material compensations, whatever they may be. That's not what I was seeking here. But someone else who is seeking those things will now feel like what they're looking for is being dismissed out of hand. But it's because we're not understanding what each of us are seeking to achieve. And so if someone is going to talk about reconciliation, then they have to know what that word means and then intend it. We can't not intend the thing we say we are seeking. So I'm skeptical when I hear certain people, particularly some pundits in the media or even in our federal government, to be honest, who use the word reconciliation. But I wonder if they have a working definition of what they mean by that. What the church understands reconciliation to mean is the coming together again of two parts that have experienced a division. And it's an intimate coming together. It is a looking into the heart and the soul of the other and seeing whatever brokenness there might be there, and then desiring to be the minister of mercy to the other's wounds. And so where the church right now seeks to be a minister of mercy to those who are wounded by the legacy of the residential school, she is seeking to do that institutionally through forms of compensation, both materially, financially, as well as with the investment of time and resources and attention but then also by accompaniment and showing that the church still desires to be pastorally present and available to these people who are suffering or desirous of being ministered to by the church. So that is what we have to bring to the table. But reconciliation is not a one-way street. If it's a one-way street, then it isn't reconciliation. Maybe it's conciliation, but it's not the coming together of two sides. And so those who are coming from the side of a different kind of woundedness also need to see the woundedness of the church and say, look, she has accepted that the errors, whatever can be called errors of the past, have inflicted wounds to the body of Christ. And I have a capacity to be a minister to those wounds as well, to promote the healing and restoration of others. And so I think that translates principally into forgiveness. And where there is an unwillingness to forgive, there is no possible future of reconciliation. I'm not questioning anyone who doesn't feel able or willing to forgive. I can sympathize, humanly speaking, with the kind of pain that some people would bear that would make them say, I can't or I won't forgive. I accept that. But then we need to be accepting of the fact that that means then it is not reconciliation that we are seeking to achieve here. So how can we meet each other on the terms that both are able to agree upon and just be honest about that? Otherwise, one side will be thinking it's doing one thing and another side will be thinking it's doing something else, and we'll miss each other like ships in the night.
As I ask this next question, I have the voice of your Kokum in my head. What was it you said she often repeated, that we need to move forward?
If we're going to move forward, we need to forgive.
We need to forgive. And particularly looking ahead to the upcoming delegation of Indigenous elders and youth to the Vatican, and then beyond that, the Holy See has signaled that the Pope may actually make a visit to Canada at some point in the near future, which may or may not involve a formal apology or statement along those lines. Putting that all in the context of what has been a series of apologies by all the actors involved within the Catholic community, within the Christian churches, starting in the 90s and starting with the orders of nuns and priests who ran the schools, and also involving the diocese, the individual diocese where those schools were located, and then progressing into the 2000s, multiple apologies by individual bishops, by groups of bishops within Canada. I think it was in the late 2000s, I'm going to say 2008, 2009, that Pope Benedict XVI received a delegation of Indigenous visitors. And my understanding, I think the leader of the Assembly of First Nations at the time, Phil Fontaine, essentially said publicly, you know, we met with His Holiness Pope Benedict and we appreciated what he had to say and, you know, apology accepted. I'm paraphrasing, but that was essentially the message. So I asked this next question with a little bit of trepidation. At what point is another apology going to tip the scales?
Well, I think back on an annoying habit I used to have as a child, according to my mother, that I would incessantly apologize. The instant I thought that even the slightest bit of trouble was lurking on the horizon, I was already apologizing. And one day she sort of blew up at me. She said, "Would you quit saying you're sorry?" And I said, "I'm sorry." it came out of me. The lesson I took from that is the frequency with which we multiply our apologies only diminishes their value. And so I do have some fear that if we don't understand what we're asking for, we may find ourselves in a position where we repeatedly ask for something that never seems to satisfy. I'm not going to go so far as to say that if Pope Francis comes to Canada and offers a clear, unmistakable apology in the name of the Universal Church for the legacy of residential schools in this country, that it's necessarily going to do any harm. I would not go that far to say. But I don't know that it's going to achieve what tends to be touted as the automatic good that will come from it. Because I don't know how dramatically different it will sound or be received than previous iterations of the same. And that could produce an incredible amount of discouragement, especially if there are some who this time around do feel what they've sought has been met and they are relieved. If they encounter someone, maybe even a close friend or family member, who says, "Oh, I can't believe you bought that. He didn't mean that, or it wasn't said in this way, or I won't accept it until he gets down on his knees," you know, whatever. The person who was willing to accept it is the one who ends up disadvantaged. The Pope can come, say he's sorry, get on a plane and go back to Italy. And that will be that for him. If anyone thinks that the pain that is continuing to be felt is now going to be resolved, it won't be. It could be further healed. There is unmistakably going to be, for some, a healing that would come from such an experience. But not for all, and I don't even know if for many. That would have to yet to be determined, and we can't sell short the role of God's grace intervening and bringing something out of such an occasion that we can't even fathom right now. But I think it is extremely important that if there are those who are willing to accept that forgiveness must be and therefore can be on the table, that there is followed up with that an important qualification about the nature of forgiveness, being that it is offered only when someone still feels the offender is in their debt, and that you don't have something to forgive when total restitution has been made. When you make your last mortgage payment, the bank doesn't send you a note forgiving you of your debt. It's done. Debt's paid. It's just a congratulatory note. But when you forgive, it implies that the person is still in your debt, that restitution has not yet fully been made. And if that's the case, I hope that there are those who are able to see that their freedom, their experience of personal freedom, does rest in that capacity to forgive in the future. Because another apology or another $10 or $100 million will still leave those who are hurting wanting. And that's what pains me, is the fear of imagining such a scenario.
Particularly for our listeners in Canada who are not of Indigenous background, there's this sense of helplessness. There's this sense of, I love the church, I love my country, but I don't know what to do. I don't know what to think. I want to help. I want to do something. I have no idea. How would you counsel those folks?
I always tell people the first basic principle is seek to meet and interact with Indigenous Canadians, especially those who are the most hard-pressed, the ones who are suffering. Now, some people may find themselves in a geographical situation where that's just unlikely. That's also part of the situation. I say that coming from Western Canada, where it's never unlikely that you can meet and interact with Indigenous people. Now, it's my heritage, so I do so very comfortably as with a brother. It's not an issue to me. But for someone who just sits at home and watches CBC News and wrings their hands and feels sorry but helpless, well, there's only one thing that you can do, and that is to try and meet the other as other, to avail yourself of educational opportunities. There's a profound richness in coming to understand how Native people in these lands lived on these lands. What was their agricultural output? What was the societal organizations that they observed? There is something very profound to be discovered in seeking to know and understand that better. And so even showing that interest and that willingness, you know, if your city is putting on some kind of exhibition where you can go and take an interpreted guided tour of something like that, that's I think a very important thing for people in Canada to do, that helps to foster a sense of, okay, people who think that they used to have this and then some strangers came and it's all gone, right? I understand why they're hurting. And where some of this frustration comes from, where a sense of a lost identity comes from. I've been making a parallel lately with young Catholics who are purporting to rediscover the richness of tradition in Catholicism. Why is that happening? Well, because there's something there that they didn't know had been there all along. And some of them are left standing, scratching their heads, saying, why was this taken from me? Where did it go? Why did I have to go looking for it? How can I have it back? Well, you've just stepped into the moccasins, as it were, of generations of Indigenous Canadians who would say the same thing about their culture. And to seek to understand that dynamic, I think, is an extremely important thing that as Catholics at this time in the history of our church, we are uniquely positioned to do with greater empathy.
I mean, certainly as part of the package of solutions, you pray and you foster devotion. We are blessed with the example of saints of Indigenous background. I think in particular of St. Kateri Tekakwitha. I'm not sure if you know the story of Rose Prince in British Columbia, who is an Indigenous woman, attended a residential school as a student. And after her graduation, she actually requested to stay. And she was a member of the faculty, died at a very early age, tragically from tuberculosis. And miracles have been associated with her gravesite. And there's an annual pilgrimage to her gravesite involving largely Indigenous Christian pilgrims. And from what I understand, there's an active process underway exploring the prospect of her beatification or canonization. Did those saints play a role in your upbringing or in your faith journey? Or do you have a special devotion to them? And if we're looking to do something, can we do worse than having a devotion to our holy brethren?
No, I think that's such an integral part of what we can be doing. I have a very early memory. There was a series of books about the lives of the saints that was in my elementary school library. They're very thin little volumes. And on the left side of the page was a full page picture of the saint. And on the right side was just a one page, very brief biography of them. I loved those books, and I remember taking them out and flipping through them. And when I discovered the page of, at that time, still Blessed Kateri, my heart just leapt for joy as a little boy when I said, wow, this is part of my heritage. This woman is someone I could especially relate to. I was so excited to tell her story to my kokum. And she knew about her, even though herself not a Catholic. And she encouraged me to love her and to learn about her. That sort of thing reminds us that the church cannot just be regarded as an institution that came and participated in a government-run program to educate a group of people in this country in a particular way. We have to see, first and foremost, the primary mission of the church to be the proclamation of the gospel and the salvation of souls. And there is no one who is to be excluded from that. When our Lord said, go and proclaim the gospel to all nations, I know that he also meant the first nations of these yet to be discovered lands by those who first heard the gospel. And that needs to be what resonates with us, that there is no one who should not hear the gospel of Christ, but who should also not encounter Christ by the respect and love that is shown for the inherent human dignity in all of us, including our Indigenous brothers and sisters.
Amen to that. Father Cristino, thank you so much for joining us today, for telling your story, your family story, your kokum story. This has been a real blessing. I'm sure many people will draw inspiration and strength and encouragement and will take inspiration and guidance from much of what you've shared with us and look to incorporate that into ways that they can contribute to true reconciliation. So thanks so much again for your time, and God bless.
Thank you. God bless you all.
Thanks for tuning in. If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts, and help us to reach more listeners by leaving us a rating or referring us to a friend. If you'd like to partner with us in the delivery of this podcast, head on over to our website at crownandcrozier.com and click the heart button in the top right-hand corner to learn more about making a one-time or monthly donation. We're sincerely grateful for you listening in, and we look forward to providing you with future episodes on church, state, and faithful citizenship. Until then, God bless.